Welcome again to Back to the Future, a podcast that puts those once and future predictions we've collectively made under the hindsight spotlight. My name is Martin Raymond, and this week I'm joined by Henry Patino Mason, forecaster, entrepreneur, and former MD of one of my favorite foresight networks, trendwatching.com. Henry, you're very welcome.
It's lovely to be here.
Well, the thing is, I'm actually quite a privilege because I've known you for quite a long time. And really, I've been tempted so many times to ask you to come on the program to do what I think a lot of us as forecasters hate doing, which is to discuss a forecast or a foresight or a scenario which potentially we've got wrong. And famously, mine was, of course, predicting that Meghan and Harry would never appear on Oprah, which obviously after last night, I now have to go back groveling and apologize to the various people and hand over some cash. But really, what it taught me, and I'm hoping this is what will come out in today's show, is that when we get predictions wrong, or we discuss them and they're not quite what we expected them to be, we still learn from those particular shifts and changes. So really, I'm going to talk about this later. But before we do that, I really wanted just to look back at your career, because I think now that you're moving on elsewhere, it would be good to take a kind of a quick look back. And I think you began it was politics and international relations at Nottingham, which I think you started out. How did you move from one area which seems to be quite defined and very particular into an area such as forecasting? What were the shifts that you went through?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question, because I think, and certainly Martin, you've been one of the great spearheaders of trend education and foresight education, and to be honest, so have we been at trend watching, and I think it's the piece that actually links us so strongly is that we're both really committed to helping people develop this muscle themselves, right, around trend watching. But there's a certain irony in that, because of course I had absolutely zero training or qualifications or experience in foresight. So, I guess the common thread, as you've alluded to there. So, I started my degree was in politics and international relations, which I guess I was just fascinated by kind of how the world works. That was really what drew me to that undergraduate degree. Then, to be honest, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with it. I didn't want to go into politics. That was for sure. But I ended up going to KPMG to become a qualified accountant, and I was in their kind of consulting division. I actually had six.
That's quite a shot. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I had 6 months as an auditor, which I realized was a kind of terrible decision. But I guess the common thread there, or one of the things that attracted me to it, was everyone said, you get a really great grounding in kind of how businesses work. So in my head, I was going to go from how the world works to how businesses work. And it was a kind of way of almost, in my mind, it was like a paid MBA. You could live in London, you'd have a few years with your mates. And that was the idea. Of course, I got in there and realized, the glossy recruitment fair pitch that they give you at university was quite different when you were ticking spreadsheets at 2 a.m. In Canary Wharf.
Well, I guess, in some ways, if you think about the as you mentioned, the politics, you think about international relations, and then you move into an area which, talk about things like even auditing, accounting. In some ways, the connective thread is that you're having to pay attention to, I guess, patterns and to data and to shifts that may indicate something else. So maybe you were already beginning to see a pathway that you weren't quite clear that it would take you through to forecasting. Because I always think, in the initial stages, we set out not sure about where we're going to, but little things are leading us along this route. If I think about myself in journalism, thinking about writing about culture, writing about politics, writing about the arts, and how all of those things knitted together to take me on a forward journey. So if I kind of put that back to you and ask you to consider what were the other elements that at the time, maybe it wasn't clear, but later when you look back, as we're doing now, it was telling you that forecasting would potentially be an area for you to work in?
Well, I mean, that's exactly as you've hinted at there. You've nailed it, right? It's the same as the kind of Steve Jobs commencement speech where he talks about you can't join the dots in the moment. You know, they don't make sense at the time, but it's only looking back. And, you know, to be honest, there was never a grand strategic plan for me to work in forecasting. And it's interesting, when I think back now, you know, looking back even further, I have quite a vivid memory, which you know, I think is a little bit like one of those recovered memories. Again, it wasn't something that I held with me all the way through, but it was only when I got into working at Trendwatching, but I remembered that we had this guy. I was at school, actually, not a million miles from where you're sitting now, out in Suffolk, in this kind of Suffolk countryside, but you will know, for listeners, that there's a big BT office there, and we had someone from BT come, you know, to do a kind of school assembly. And I, as I said, it was only 15 years later, 25 years later, whatever it was, and I remember thinking, wow, like, what an amazing job. He was a kind of futurist, I guess. Like, this is, you know, mid-80s, so the word, they were pretty speculative.
A great term that was popular at that time, yes, futurism.
Yeah. But I do have this memory of thinking, wow, that would be kind of such an interesting job, just to like think about where things are headed. So I think there was kind of, you know, perhaps some deep rooted desire, you know, for this type of career. But you know, to actually make the transition, really, it was a couple of friends of mine who basically that, you know, we were like mid-20s at the time, and I was a kind of frustrated, you know, corporate grad scheme accountant, broadly speaking, you know, consultant in accountancy. So, you know, thinking about what was coming next, and the financial crash was happening, and, you know, there was a lot of turbulence. And a couple of my friends saw this job ad, and I'd actually missed it, and they saw it, and they both sent it to me, basically saying, you know, please, can you kind of apply for this so you don't kind of bore us down the pub with, and I was famous amongst my friends for saying, you know, I've just read an article about, and then regaling them with some story. And I think what was really interesting to me was, it's a very powerful signal to me, and thinking to anyone else actually looking to get it, you know, either to change career or get
it. It's interesting that your friends were seeing characteristics in you, which they were already relating to the notion that you could be, you know, a forecaster, futurist. So I guess there were traits and characteristics and things you were discussing, which I always think is a good indicator as well. If I'm recruiting or looking for people who can fit this slightly hybrid category of researcher, analyst, you know, forward thinker, that sometimes those skills are not obvious, but when you listen to the conversation, depending on how they pitch things or discuss things, and that, I guess, your friends were picking up on the curiosity you had about newness and innovation, which I think is probably one of the things that everybody looks for. I mean, what are the things now that if you're recruiting or thinking about bringing people into this strange hybrid industry, what will you try to locate within them that would tell you they have the things that you have as a forecaster?
Well, yes, that's a great question. And you know, one of the things that I think I did that got me the job actually was, you know, because I was you know, quite junior at KPMG, and I had a bit of time when I saw this job ad again, and it was kind of total chutzpah, really. It was a job ad for a senior strategist, and I was neither senior nor a strategist, but something in me felt compelled to apply. And actually, laughing with Rainier, the founder of Trendwatching, yeah, he said, you know, I was everything that he didn't want to hire. I mean, he had zero ambition to hire someone from KPMG. But basically, he asked for your top trends and your favorite sources. What are you reading? And it's funny, being on the other side of it, and I don't know if you have a similar kind of request in your job ads, being on the other side of the job ads, the job, you know, applications, as we both have been for many, many years, it's mind-blowing to me how many people will just write one sentence for their three favorite trends, you know, and it'll be like mobile apps or whatever, you know, that was 10 years ago, and now it'll be AI and, you know, whatever it'll be. And, you know, list two sources and it'll be TED. And you know, I think basically kind of did a semi-memory dump of about 50 sources, but including the top 10 articles that I'd read. You know, at the time it was things like Chris Anderson's The Long Tail and some stuff from Kevin Kelly, but, you know, went really granular into these are articles that have made a profound effect on me. And then actually wrote a mini trend report, basically. You know, I wrote kind of 300-400 words with examples and images, and it, you know, I guess part of that was because I had, you know, no credibility really, so I had to pour everything into this job application. But it also, you know, he said basically he kind of felt guilty that I'd spent so much time preparing the job application that he felt compelled to.
I guess, but also, you know, to do it, you've got the great question: what is it you're looking for? And I think you've rightly identified not just, you know, the kind of inputs people make, but I guess we're looking for context as well as content, looking for some analysis, because I'm thinking about when you started in the kind of business, and I guess if you started trend watching in 2010, if you think about that period, we had called it the turbulent teens. So, you know, the beginning of the Arab Spring, you'd come out of the GFC, you had that big lesbian, gay, trans rights push, so the beginning of the decade. But you also had, you know, the kind of great Edward Snowden, stories being released. We had WikiLeaks. So suddenly, as a person famously said to me at that point, there were a lot of trends and a lot of changes. You know, for once we are seeing this buffeting world of challenges. But how were you thinking, or what were you thinking when you found yourself at trend watching in this kind of period, which was about massive change and massive switchover, and I guess also massive opportunity for somebody paying attention to what was happening in the marketplace?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I know, as you said in your introduction, we're going to come on to kind of some of the blind spots later. But I think, you know, for us at Trendwatching, we've always taken just a hugely optimistic view of trends and innovation. And you know, so out of all of the kind of things that you're looking back at there, you know, when we were discussing this beforehand, I was thinking about trying to take myself back to that time. And I think we were probably much more focused than you, rather than on the turbulence, than as you said, that you finished on there on the opportunity. And I think the big piece for us was the global piece, you know, and it seemed like it was kind of the second, I mean, depending on where you count, it was kind of wasn't the first wave of the internet, and where that first wave came is very debatable, right? Was it, you know, 70s, 80s? But let's say that this felt like it was the beginnings of the true globalization of the internet, you know, in terms of popular adoption. You know, if you think back, the 2000 to 2010, you know, you're still in the hundreds of millions of people, tens to hundreds of millions of people worldwide. You know, then that decade, you're looking at the hundreds to the billions of people becoming connected. And so, yes, there was all of the disruption, but it was, you know, even as you mentioned there, you know, you've called out a couple of kind of competing trends, and I would argue what was kind of surprising is actually how long it took for the ripples of the great financial crash. You know, it almost, there was that wave, wasn't it? And then it kind of went quiet actually for five, you know, 10, and it was really Brexit and Trump. And, you know, now we're almost seeing more of the backlash against, it was kind of brushed under the carpet. And
I guess the kind of seeds were laid, because I was thinking about that period, you know, 2010s, and if you think about now, like the whole issue of, you know, plant-based, vegan, CBD, you know, that kind of dismantling of globalization, etc., you were seeing that on one side, and seeing that rise of populist alt-right, fairly kind of strong anti-democratic sentiment on the other. So there was quite a lot of turbulence happening. But also, and this is where I think for trend watches, it was probably quite excellent, is that suddenly in that turbulence, you would see new brands, product, services. And really, I guess when I would look at trend watching, which was what, you know, is one of our competitors in some ways, it was always a great source to check and validate our own thinking. So I'd go, well, okay, we're thinking about X and these new innovations coming through. And I would go to check out, you know, one of 10 sites, yours being number 14. I go, wow, okay, we're kind of on the right path. And it really occurred to me that a lot of people, particularly those big accountancy firms who now run their own foresight and strategic foresight divisions, weren't seeing turbulence in the same way that I think we were seeing it, as opportunity rather than as something that was disrupting markets in a negative way. I mean, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think, again, you've definitely touched on something really important there in the evolution of the industry. And, you know, if you think back to, you know, trend watching was 2002. When was Future Lab founded? A similar kind of time?
2001. So that was exactly that.
You were always the pioneer, Martin. But, you know, if you think back to, you know, and there were many other people, you know, the Foresight Factory and you know, PSFK as well. There was definitely, in my mind, you know, there was the first wave, which was before I got into the industry. There, you know, you guys, you know, you and Chris and as I say, Piers and Rainier were very much, I think, the first wave of very early on in the trend industry and really creating. I mean, you know, if you think back, I mean, there was obviously the Shell for scenario planners and, you know, Lee Edelcourt and Faith Popcorn. But I think you were the first wave of, you know, digitally native, or certainly online first, you know, not digital native in the Gen Z sense of the
world. And I guess also the fact that you're looking at, you know, we talk about trends, but the big issue is the consequences of the impact. And I think that was the big shift, because a lot of people in fashion, you know, people like Lee, for example, Faith Popcorn particularly, they were looking at the waves of change without necessarily going, well, what is the impact of that wave? So the impact of the wave towards, you know, organic, or towards local, or towards you know a more disgruntled, diffused consumer. What does that mean? And I think that was the bit that probably distinguished trends from forecasting, and I guess also forecasting from foresight. We were looking at, I guess, those stepped changes that would tell you, well, if this is happening now, how will that play out over the next decade? And that, I think, so, you know, to go back to the work you were doing, what I always liked and admired was how you gave examples of, here's what will happen. Here are the case studies of, you know, early market solutions. And these are the learnings you can take from it to help your business. And I think they were the bits that really changed the industry into the sector it has become. So, you know, from what I call voodoo forecasting to now, where, you know, the analysis, the insight, the data, the extrapolation you apply is pretty rigorous across the board. And I think that's where it became an industry. I mean, did you feel that, or was that me fantasizing that I could just, you know, have a better brand image than the one of being a futurist? When I went once to Miami Airport and this guy said to me, so what, I'm a futurist. He said, well, okay, so can you read my palm? He thought it was a palm reader, in the way that a lot of people see futurism as kind of, you know, guesswork with adjectives, as it was once described to me.
Yeah, I know. I think you've absolutely nailed it there in terms of that transition from observation to, you know, what the implication, right? And then actually strategic execution as well, you know. And I think that is really where the industry has to head, because and I'm sure we'll come on to this, you know, in terms of observation. I mean, human powered observation is so limited now versus, you know, machine driven observation and data collection. So you're always fighting a losing battle if you're going to try and, you know, win in the observation sphere if you're human powered, and therefore, you know, where are humans left if it is the implications? And as you say, you know, I think there was a huge moment when Accenture bought Fjord, and you know, they were arguably, and I'm sure there was, you know, something before that, but that was definitely when we started to see the accountancies and the consultancy firms, you know, get closer into this space. And I think it's very hard to think about the industry, the forecasting industry, without thinking about it as interwoven with the design industry as well. And I think that's a kind of interesting, you know, parallel human-centered design. And you know, just as we've talked about trends, right, it's very hard to separate out all of these silos, and there's that kind of dual competing tendency towards hyper specialization, but also, you know, crossing silos and breaking down silos, mm-hmm. and blurring. And so, you know, it's a mixed picture of one that we always used to try and I don't know how satisfactorily we did this, but we used to say, look, you know, in a way, we know that trends and consumer trends, I mean, we used to try and even focus down on what do we mean by trends. Your consumer trends are 1 or 2% of what an innovation, you know, what an organization who's trying to innovate actually needs. And we're going to try and be the best in the world at that small slice of, you know, what we focus on. And we're going to, you know, partner and collaborate with the design thinking team and the human, you know, the human-centered design and the, you know, the data-driven quant insight function. And, you know, there was all of it, you know, there was all of this. And it became, the whole field became kind of messier and clearer at the same time in terms of, you know, everyone was, and of course that created opportunities for the big players to come and roll everyone up and be your end-to-end solution, but also the boutiques to carve out their niche. And it's like every industry, you know, the people in the middle were kind of, I think, left high and dry, and you know, advantages flowed kind of up the pyramid and down the pyramid, and you know, in equal measures. And it is a fascinating time in terms of thinking about how the trends that we're watching ourselves actually then feed back into our own industry. And that's something that always fascinates me, actually. And I think, I know it fascinates you as well. There's that very meta analysis that we have to do on the future of content, the future of insight, the future of foresight, all of these things that you've mentioned, because we're not immune to it, just like our own clients are.
Well, I guess the, you know, the big issue is, as we said at the beginning, when we set out, there was no industry. Then you had, you know, numbers of disparate, interesting companies having those conversations. And, you know, then it moved on to where you realize you were seeing the word trends being superseded by the word, you know, foresight or strategic foresight as it is now. And then suddenly those big players coming in, but my suspicion is that they still are not clear about what it is they're trying to do. You know, are you simply trying to you know, become sexier and to have a better brand image among your peers by using terms and having debates about the future that you know, seem slightly sexier than, you know, dull analysis or grim market statistics, or, you know, somebody said the worst refuge of the desperate, bringing an economist in to ask economists about the future. You know, if they knew about the future, they'd be quite wealthy, but they're always poor because the forecasts and predictions are never right. And also they're never interesting. So somebody is saying that suddenly these big firms are there because they realize there's value to be gained out of the, I guess, the splurging of the visual and the data and the textual and the you know, future facing together and coming up with a point of view or a kind of snapshot of the future that allows you to potentially bring in more imaginative scenarios, which I think is where we seem to be at the moment. You know, I'm kind of looking at McKinsey, I'm looking at Accenture, looking at the work we do, etc. And I'm seeing it's kind of more interesting, and the client has stopped asking about accuracy because I think their understanding of the future is not predictable in that traditional sense. You're kind of looking for the signs, looking for visual clues, indicators of this is how it could be, and then you look and maybe move forward into that. So I'm just kind of wondering, would you say that forecasting has become more sexy? That's the first part of my question. But if it has, or even if you think it hasn't, do you think it's become more accurate, or is it just different? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, and this is where I think we have a slightly different point of view, or not point of view, but, and I guess, you know, as I say my point of view, I almost can I'm picking holes in it myself. So I'm not sure how much I believe it in terms of it's very much a politician's way out. But I wrote an article about this a couple of years ago after I read Philip Tetlock's Super Forecasting. And it was kind of the issue that I had with really your whole premise around this podcast. And I mean that in the nicest possible way, in that I read this book, Super Forecasting. And for those of you, I'm sure you've read it, Martin, but for those of your listeners who haven't read it, you know, it's an absolute must read. So Philip Tetlock is this guy who basically, I believe he ran or just wrote about it, I forget whether he was running it. He ran the kind of Good Judgment Project, which was this initiative by the US government post 9/11, when they basically said, like, why is it that we have, you know, these thousands of highly paid we spend billions of dollars a year.
Exactly,
on our entire intelligence community. No one saw this coming, right? Like, how bad are we at forecasting? And just as an aside, he was the guy who popularized the concept of the monkeys throwing darts at the dartboard for stock picking, and they would outperform some of the some of the professional stock pickers. So that was one kind of his initial experiment. And so he ran this competition, and they had it was essentially a prediction market. And so they had it was open to anyone, including intelligence analysts, but people could make predictions about the American government would pick, they'd publish 100 questions, and it would be, you know, will the price of oil be above $80 on a certain date?
Israel invade Iraq. Yes, exactly. It was all the questions, I guess, that the CIA were meant to be answering. And I think that was his point. And also that the fact that he believed, while specialists had some knowledge, generalists had a better understanding, but specialists in themselves could become silos. So I guess what he was doing was spreading the risk across the market, not, as he said, not just average people, but people who had an average to good interest in general things. So there's a greater sweep. And I think that was that sort of wisdom of crowds thinking, you know, that if you had the right questions, or rather you had that, you know, big enough crowd with some intelligence, checking their biases, because I think that was a trick also. You constantly challenge and updated all of the data they have to make assumptions about, so that there was no point during the forecast they were simply sitting back and going, well, that's the answer, which I think he was saying in the book, that the CIA, once they had reached certain conclusions, that would be their conclusion. And any other data that would come in after that to challenge it was slightly discarded or put to one side.
So I think massive confirmation bias.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I obviously read this book being a trend watcher, thinking, you know, this is really important, right? Well, I really need to know how to become one of these super forecasters. And right up front, I think it's in the introduction, you know, he's extremely dismissive of people like Thomas Friedman, and you know, he's extremely dismissive of kind of professional pundits, basically, who in his words, kind of make unfalsifiable predictions, right? Yes. So instead of this idea of saying, you know, Israel will invade X country in the Middle East by a certain date, right, which is either right or wrong, and you can have a confidence threshold, and you can say, I believe this, and I'm 80% confident. He said, you know, Thomas Friedman will just say, the Middle East is a tinderbox, right? It might blow up. And he would say, well, when, you know, in what direction? You know, there's all, you know, it's a very vague and unfalsifiable prediction about the future, and therefore it's useless, right? So he's extremely dismissive of basically the types of predictions that we at Trend Watching, you know, and dare I say it, you at Future Lab would make. But there's a really interesting bit. So kind of, you know, your hackles are up reading this book a little bit, because you're kind of like, well, you know. But he goes all the way through the book and he explains all the skills that you've just mentioned around these super forecasters who seem to be able to make actually better than average predictions. But there's a really important bit, I think, in the epilogue where he talks about, he kind of goes back to his introduction. He says, actually, you know, I'm very dismissive of these people like Thomas Friedman, but actually their real skill is not actually the falsifiable nature of their predictions, right? Because they don't know. What they're good at is actually helping us know where we should even be looking, right? Because, you know, we're the American government and we publish 100 questions, or maybe it's 500 questions. But the truth is we could publish a million questions. You know, there's a bigger question around what is the landscape in which we should even be asking questions about the future.
And I guess the skill, because if you think about how a lot of forecasters, a lot of forecasting groups now work, you have a wide network. So you're pushing out from specialism to generalism. You're probably, and I guess, you know, this is the big point, is recruiting unlike-minded people. So his other point in the book is that you have people who are not sharing similar networks, or who are not connected by, you know, maybe culture, by sector, by kind of industry education. So at all times, you're trying to ensure diversity from the very beginning, with the view that when you put the questions out, the biases that would normally exist within like-minded groups, or you know, what he calls the kind of heterophilous thinking, isn't as obvious, and therefore the potential of getting answers that are more accurate and better and closer to the forecast is possibly the kind of truth you're looking for. And I think that's, if you think about a lot of forecasting businesses now, trend watching included, that it's a scatter effect. It's the wider number of people, it's the cultural diversity, it's the fact that you ask more questions with a view to, I guess, kind of almost ring fencing an area, to your point, and then you zoom in on that area. You kind of get closer to, well, not just the answer, because I always think in itself, it may not be the answer that you're looking for. You're looking for the right question, because then that gives you a different cascade or a thinking. And that, I guess, kind of that was in to my next point, in where, you know, you did a book recently where you looked at trend-driven innovation. And I always think, again, you know, the difference between some people identify the trends. Some people are going, okay, let's, you know, canvas our network to find out what these areas of change are an opportunity. But once you've done that, and this is where I'd use your book. When I was writing my book, I was using it for reference sources, you know, quotes from it, etc. And you know, what struck me again was that you were then helping people to make the next step with, you know, this is the trend, this is the thing, how you unlock that in a fairly not straightforward, but a way that was profitable and opportunistic. And I'm just wondering if you could just talk me through some of the methodologies and techniques that you identified through the book that you feel people listening will find useful when they're, you know, getting on from the trend into implementing it and turning it into something that they can flog onto the marketplace.
Yeah, well, That's a great question. And actually, I'll kind of hold up my hands and say that the specifics of your question, and I'll expand it to kind of give myself a bit of breathing room, but about how to turn insights into innovations. I mean, we had a process of how to get there in terms of the innovation ideas, which was loosely, I mean, we tried to take our own medicine, which was because we, you know, essentially trend watching, as you say, was really about looking at innovation examples and using them for inspiration around where things are headed for your own business. So that was always our kind of core IP, was to say, you know, look at innovations instead of actually consumers themselves. But actually the piece from an insight into actually the market facing or market ready innovation was actually where we were weakest, because we weren't a consultancy. So if you actually look at what we laid out the book in terms of, I think there were five chapters in terms of, you know, how to look, how to scan for trends, how to choose the right trends, how to then turn those trends into innovation ideas, then there was a chapter on, you know, how to actually get them into the marketplace. But that was by far the shortest chapter. And you just open the table of contents and you'll see it. And it's, you know, all the others have five or six subchapters and this one has one. And we kind of held up our hands. And then there was how to build a trend culture within your organization. And so that was a bit because of our business model, where we were weakest, actually. And we, and as so going back to this idea that we'll just try and do the 1% of what clients need, do it well. But actually, the reason why we were so keen to publish and really break down that first stage, which is how to spot trends and then how to choose them and how to come up with innovation ideas, because that was really our legacy. Very much was as a crowdsourced business. You know, this was back in the earliest days. Rainier, the founder, had set up this trend, you know, this open access kind of trend watching community, you know, online. And that was really the business model innovation. You know, we were laughing when we were writing the foreword of the book. We were looking back and, you know, crowdsourcing wasn't even a word. I mean, it wasn't crowdsourcing.
Exactly, yeah.
It was invented as a word in 2006, and this was 2002. So this was really innovative back at the time. And so for us, it was a kind of altruist, you know, self-interested altruism in publishing this you know, really detailed methodology of how we spot trends. Because basically we wanted to give this to the community. And we, you know, I slightly facetiously always say to people, we bought a large percentage of the copies of those books that have been sold as prizes. And you know, for clients, you know, we buy them. I mean, you know, they would be part of a package, but we'd buy them and send them to the team or send them to spotters, you know, because it was our way of saying, like, and of course, everyone who onboarded, you know, came on. And it was like, you know, I used to joke, it's a very expensive business card, but it's also kind of publicly available on boarding manual. And you know, so for us, as I say, it was kind of self-interested altruism in giving away our secret sauce, because we hoped to get it you know, better insights and better material back from our own network. And that was really the kind of flywheel that we were trying to trying to push within the business and within the industry as well. Because you were doing this even before us, Martin, as well. I mean, I've got a well-thumbed copy of the Trend Forecasters Handbook from the first edition, right? From when was that?
In some ways, it was exactly the same process, because you're doing these things, you're looking at competitor, you know, practices and methods, and some were clear. Others, to me, as you know, you pointed out before, you know, can be extremely vague or lacking in stage disciplines, because I'm always curious about, you know, first of all, you're trying to justify to businesses about what forecasters do, you know, how you do it. And then the third bit, the relevance of doing it. They then want proof that it can be done. And then they want to see results. And I go, well, you don't apply this methodology to economists you hire, to accountants you hire, to you know, actuaries or whatever. So why is this thing treated with such suspicion? And hence the book, and I think your book, it gave a framework and a confidence for people, A, to understand that it exists, B, there is a process to doing it, C, if you follow the process, there are clear outcomes, and D, it will help you identify opportunities. Because a lot of people talk to me about, you know, they run businesses, and I go, well, you maintain a business, not saying it's running it. You know, running means that you're constantly disrupting, reinventing, changing, looking at newness. But the majority of CEOs who you and I guess were dealing with tended to be caretakers of businesses at best. And at worst, they would tinker with some opportunistic shift that they could claim was a new product or a new service. And you go, really? You know, this is new. This is innovation disruption. And I think what you know, the book was teaching people. And that's why, I wouldn't undersell it, because I always think it's an important thing. It reminded people of what you're doing when you're looking at culture, you know, when you're evaluating it, when you're tracking it, when you're codifying it, when you're then unpacking it in a way to become something other, i.e. product, brand, or service. And now, people, I think good people using these things take it for granted, but there's still that group of CEOs and that who still demand, and I often, you know, I'd recommend your book or throw my book at them or equivalent, Because I say, look, it's there if you want it. And to your point about giving it, if you give it to people, they understand how difficult it is. They go, oh, fuck, this is really hard. Actually, I need to bring in experts. Or did you find that one of the reasons for doing it was to demonstrate, you know, this is how it's done, but I'm not sure you'll be able to do it. So bring in the experts to do it.
Of course, yeah. And I think, you know, we were playing with, if you like, this sense that on the one hand, we were really trying to democratize trend watching and make it accessible. And I think that the key thing that we used to hear back from clients, and the thing that I think we really did well at, was reinforcing that all trends are grounded in basic human needs. And actually, you know, you said that, you know, business executives are obsessed with the novelty and always want to be talking about the disruption that they're launching and the new thing, right? And you know, so many conversations with clients, and they'd say, well, we've looked at these trends, you know, we've looked at AI and the Internet of Things and, you know, whatever, and they'd reel off a whole load of technologies, you know, and I'd say to them, you know, these are not trends, these are technologies. If you're really thinking about your, you know, back then it was 2020 trend strategy, now it's 2030 trend strategy, or if someone's feeling really ambitious, it'll be your 2050 trend strategy, you know, pick a number that the C-suite have decided they're going to rally the organization around. And they would say, you know, I've looked at all these trends. I said, you know, that they're not trends, they're technologies. You know, if you're going to think about this, you need to start from a position of, why does our business even exist in the minds of customers? And you know, it was really one of the big aha moments for us, one of the big useful things. And I'm going to, you know, claim that we got there first, although obviously he has a much broader audience, is when Jeff Bezos. There's an amazing quote from Jeff Bezos that we always put in our presentations. It was actually after the book, so it's not in there, where he says, you know, people always ask me what's going to change, you know, what should I be? Yep. He said, it's much more important to focus on what's not going to change. You know, he says, you know, that's what you can build a business around for the next 10 years. And of course, it's what, and he says this, it's what no executives can do, really, you know, of listed companies, right? They can't have a long-term view because they're so obsessed with chasing the next quarter's numbers. And, you know, he says at Amazon, you know, we know that, you know, in 10 years time, no customer is going to ask us for, you know, slower delivery time, higher prices and a smaller selection of products. You know, it's just not going to happen. And what I used to say is, you know, the classic thing is, you know, at Amazon, you can be pretty confident that everyone in the organization can parrot off, you know, those three, you know, basic customer needs that they are building their business around. And you can be equally certain that in 99% of other big corporates, you know, you ask 100 people, what are the basic customer needs that we're serving? And they will not give you as clearly aligned answer as they
will. They can. Yeah. And I think that's the, I guess, the comms thing, but also it's the lack of vision, because I always think that, you know, with foresight, forecasting, you know, all of those things about looking forward, that a lot of companies, you know, particularly quite a lot of CEOs, they have a mission. And I go, they confuse the mission with the vision, which is, what is this thing, the road that we're laying out? What's the mechanism that will get us along this road? What are the obstacles? How do we overcome them? And what's our final legacy when we look back along that road that we wanted to leave behind? And that, to me, is how, you know, good forecasting works. And yet, I think people, you know, they confuse it with, it's a quicker product, it's a more efficient X, it's a faster car, etc. And I always think they're not really, it's because maybe they don't own the businesses, but also because, you know, vision is a very particular thing to have, and a lot of people confuse it with that sort of, you know, the mission statement, we will be a great service brand, you know, we will offer great value for money. And my question is, A, how, B, why, and probably, you know, they're the questions they can't really tell you, because that, you know, CEOs are gone by the time the real turbulence or change hits their particular sector or marketplace.
Absolutely.
I mean, just on future things. I think we're reaching that midpoint in the program. There was two midpoints. We can't really have two, but they're just the. I know you are moving on to other sectors and industries, but also you're co-writing a book at the moment, which I think is ongoing for a particular reason, with Rohit Fargava, called The Future Normal. And I've sort of been reading snippets about it and fragments that seem to be appearing, but nothing concrete. What is the book about, and you know, why have you started a book called The Future Normal now? What am I likely to find in it?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I mean, it's really we toyed around with the title, and you know, we ended up with The Future Normal, but it's also the subtitle is The Ideas and Instigators Building a Fairer, Healthier, Greener Future for Us All. And so part of the motivation was, you know, both him and you know, me, we share a kind of quite an optimistic view of the future. And I mean, there will of course be some chapters that we look at where things, you know, obviously could take a darker turn, but it's meant to be an exploration of how we can, you know, build back better. You know, the famous, I mean, we're all the slogans, right, that people are
trotting. I've banned that slogan. I've asked people to say build back different or build back anything, but don't build back better. It reminds me of, you know, kind of getting things done during Brexit and that. I hate the term. Yeah, I always find it slightly suburban, so I'm going to challenge you on that. let's build that word differently, phrase differently. Yeah.
But I think, you know, just what to answer your question, what will you find in the book?
Yeah.
You know, to be honest, this is not a book. So it's the last book was very much a methodology book and a real unpacking of how we spot trends. This is almost the exact opposite. And, you know, because he's done that, I've done that. This is really, we were laughing, it's kind of the airport book, which is a bizarre book to write when no one is in airports. But it's, you know, the parallel that I would draw is for those of you listeners and viewers that have read the Tim Harford 50 Objects That Made the Modern Economy. Yes. So if you wanted to think of a parallel, this is, you know, whether it's 40 or 50, you know, to be, the exact number of chapters is kind of TBC, but it's basically a kind of optimist's guide to the future through the lens of just very short chapters. I mean, 3 or 4 pages on various things that we think, you know, seem niche or ridiculous today. Some of them are obviously more established, but some of them maybe a bit more science fiction-esque. But startups that can synthesize protein from CO2. Or the mosaic one, the one that I was writing over the last week, just looking at the potential for future job sharing, you know, new ways of working. So it takes in the book, the structure of the book is how we'll live and work is one section, how we'll relax and shop is another, how we'll thrive as individuals, how we'll thrive as societies, and then the final chapter being how humanity will survive. So that's the kind of arc of the book that you can see. But really it is short snippets, you know, as I said, helping show the future. And it really goes back to this idea, building on what he does on his non-obvious trend show, what I was doing at Trend Watching for a number of years, to say, if you look at some things that are happening today, you know, you can draw the insights and the implications that you can draw from those singular insights ripple beyond that immediate context of industry or market. So, you know, you might have a retail disruption in China, you know, you might have a, you know, purpose-driven innovation in South America, whatever it is, but you can start to see glimpses of the future normal. And so really it's just, you know, as you hinted at there, or as we've been discussing in the past, it's about asking as many questions as it is. And in fact, all of the chapters are kind of structured around the what if question, and really it's what if we could do X. Well, and then the answer is kind of part of this is already being answered by this, you know, this thought leader, this instigator, this startup pioneer, and then, you know, ask.
I'm so fascinated now because
it's a really fun book to write.
You've led me to that bit of the show, as you know, where we look at forecasts we have made, because it sounds like your book is exactly doing this. You're looking at you know, potential changes, opportunistic moments, you know, new pathways that are incoming that could become our great road systems for the future. And I'm just wondering, on that note, where are the things that you in the past had predicted that you got, you know, wrong, completely wrong, or just like me and my Megan thing, woefully wrong? And you know, what were those things particularly that you felt, wow, how could I have called that incorrectly?
I mean, so circling all the way back, as I said at the beginning, we were always kind of, you know, very optimistic. And that was kind of the brand proposition, was highlighting the potential opportunities. So I'd say in that sense, and this is what I, you know, why I was telling the story about super forecasting, is we weren't, you know, in a kind of politician's way, we weren't really making discrete forecasts about the future in saying this will happen. It was more saying, here's what we can see happening in the present now, in a very small slice of the market. This, you know, this could become bigger. So I think the biggest blind spot definitely that we have, and actually leading on to your question, is, you know, great that you brought up the book. In a way, I'm not tackling it. I'm kind of rushing headlong into making the same mistake again, in that it is naive, in some senses, it is naively optimistic. And I know the criticism I would make of some of the things we were talking about in 2010 was that we weren't critical enough of globalization, technology. You know, it was not totally techno-utopian, but it was very much like celebrating. And I think, you know, we definitely got caught up in that, and we weren't challenging enough. But I would kind of answer that criticism. I say I'm knowingly rushing in a way headlong into that again now in this position, because it's not, and part of it is just my own temperament, and it's you know, I don't, it's very easy to be a doom monger and a book, you know, bear, and it's more, I you know, part of me is that I just don't want to write that book, right? I prefer looking at the people that are doing really interesting things and asking questions about, imagine, like, what would the world look like if this was much more, this became the future normal, right? This is a more interesting conversation for me to have personally, for myself. So in that sense, history will inevitably repeat itself again.
I guess in some ways you're right. That, to me, is that's your learning from the failure, because, you know, a lot of the times we're, you know, either forecasting dystopian things or we're, you know, too optimistic. And I go, if I make 20 optimistic forecasts and only 10 of them come out to be correct, that's not bad. I mean, I quite like the world, you know, to kind of be a better place. And if our forecasts, because in some ways you're laying down pathways with forecasts, you know, somebody said, well, there's no prediction involved, because you in some ways you can't predict the future. You can anticipate potentials and possibilities, and by inserting that into the kind of common parlance now, there's a potential that people go, great, let's go for this, let's do it, you know. So why not choose that path, which is a good one, versus choosing the bad one? So in some ways I'm with you on this, that I think it's you know, for those failures, and I think the failures teach us how to not just be more accurate, but also to A, live with consequence, and B, to go, well, what was it that was wrong? Was it the context? Was it the time? Was it there wasn't enough belief? Because ultimately, you know, the future in that sense is a set of pathways that we plan, tell stories about. And then I guess, like the book that you're planning, by looking at those what if optimisms, it lays out a great super highway that we can potentially drive along and get the thing right. And I know that you're planning to do this, because you've left friend watching, you're now driving, keep my metaphor going, onto a different and along a different highway. And whereabouts are you planning to go to next? Where am I likely to find you stopping if I'm kind of wandering out and looking at other industries? So
that's a great, and actually it brings us really nicely onto, you know, as I touched on there, the kind of the blind spot of trend watching, but a kind of knowing blind spot was, you know, we were very focused on consumer facing innovation. And I think, you know, in that excitement of the 2010s, where globalization was happening, and that kind of cultural globalization, especially as, you know, the world came online, that was an interesting space to be. we now obviously are moving into a new decade where I think, you know, again, this techno-utopianism has faded. I mean, you know, you can argue whether it's kind of swung possibly too far the other way, but I think clearly we are in a new era. So the new role that I'm going to be doing is I'm working with Brent Hoberman and his founders for
Excellent.
To drive the content strategy there. And you know, that is a tech event, you know, or has been legacy. But one of the things that I really hope to bring to it, and, you know, the conversations that I had with them when I was joining was, you know, I am not a tech person. You know, obviously we're looking at trends and innovation, of course, you know, technology is a big part of that, but I'm not a, you know, deep tech person. And that's kind of part of the interest is, you know, what I'm bringing into that role is a new perspective. That lies outside of you know, the legacy, right? And that's part of, I think, the evolution in the technology industry is it's becoming much more deeply embedded with the wider society, the wider culture. So I think that's something that I'm really interested to as you say, to jump into an adjacent lane, to have that remit to, yes, focus on technology, but also bring a slightly different perspective than pure technology. So that's the area that I'm kind of really interested to explore over the next, you know, few years is how does this intersection, you know, play out, right? Because I don't think anyone knows. And I think anyone who's making forecasts that says, you know, they know where, I mean, if there's one lesson we've learned through history is, you know, the second order implications and the unexpected second order implications of when government intersects with, you know, anything, right? Be it technology, be it economics, be it politics, it is extremely hard to predict and dare I say impossible to predict. So helping convene and shape that conversation, I think, is just going to be unbelievably interesting in the next few years.
And also just asking those bigger questions, because I think, you know, we talk about tech, but really, if you think about Silicon Valley, you know, it's kind of created a whole new political, social, structural, ethical blast system that suddenly we're having to treat it like a country or a government or, you know, a new world order. I mean, I was chatting recently, and she's coming on one of the later podcasts, Lucy Green, who did a book called Silicon States. And here she was saying exactly that, that when we talk about tech, there's a glibness in the word that absolutely hides and disguises all of the big moral questions or ethical questions or frameworks that we need to either define or ask questions about. But I think and suddenly now we're realizing that that is the next big leap in terms of, you know, what and where these particular debates will sit on that kind of area and thinking, because obviously you have come from a forecasting background. You're going to go into this world, which is, as I said, it's not tech, it's really big questions about society and humanity that potentially you're going to have to think about. What are your forecasts for the next decade? Is there one big thing you're predicting that you're willing to, you know, stake your reputation on? This is a bit when I ask you to come back in 10 years to either say well done on your forecast or go, oh, I can't believe I got it wrong again. What's the big thing you are going to predict that I can hold you to over the coming decade?
Yeah, and I'll come on to that in just a second, because I just want to pick up as well on something that you said, you know, about Silicon Valley and the evolution of where we're at in this kind of tech-driven conversation. And I do think there's a fascinating, we are at a fascinating moment in the kind of tech, you know, story, if you like, where, you know, Silicon Valley's definitely led the conversation for the past 10 years. I think everyone is looking, you know, there's definitely, of course, just, you know, loads of attention paid to what's happening in China, rightly so. Of course, they have arguably the first kind of digital native society, with all the other political contexts around that. But one of the things that I'm excited about this new role as well is I think Europe has a really interesting, you know, part to play in this. And I think is it a forecast or an aspiration? It's certainly something that I, you know, I want to try and drive, is that you know, Europe being and I still count Britain as being, you know, European in that sense, in terms of, you know, sitting somewhere between the, as you say, the kind of, you know, Hobbesian state of, you know, techno kind of almost capital, you know, extreme techno capitalism that we see in the US, you know, very corporatist capitalism, or sorry, corporatist, techno, you know, control of a state that we see in China. And I do think there's definitely an interesting alternative perspective on the role of technology and society and the state, and, you know, and actually getting on to predictions. You know, obviously what we're seeing is, you know, the tech story move from software into kind of hardware and, you know, the future of green tech. And that's something, and I was just looking, I think it was yesterday, just one of the stories that popped up in my newsfeed was MIT Technology Review, you know, releasing their kind of green index around, you know, green technology. And European countries take 15 out of the top 20 markets in leading.
Oh, interesting. So
if you look at where the next wave of tech innovation will happening. I mean, it's a cliche to say lots of it will happen outside of the valley. You know, everyone knows that. But again, you think about what types of tech innovation will happen. You know, Europe, I think, has a really strong role to play there. So, you know, one forecast is I think and hope, and I want to be a part of, you know, driving the European voice forward in the global stage and painting a different picture of a brighter future. So that's one. You know, more granular predictions. You know, I know you're gonna give some very granular predictions. I think, you know, so again, going back to this idea, people are always obsessed with what trends, what's going to die. You know, there's a million and one articles about the death of X. You know, video killed the radio star, right?
Oh, indeed.
You know, cities won't die. The pandemic is not going to kill cities. Absolutely not. I think it's probably...
I'm with you on this one. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's a big debate over New York. Will it be dead? You know, I think it's probably, you know, all these overpriced cities, it's probably the best thing that's ever happened to them. Driving out, you know, people with too much money, or people with too much money wanting to flee to suburbia and, you know, have more space and be safer. You know, the artists will inevitably flock in. Which will be a great thing. I suspect a kind of more provocative, or to go, you know, go back to this conversation around super forecasters, you know, and making a falsifiable prediction. If I had to make a falsifiable prediction, I think by the end of, you know, the next decade, I suspect eating natural meat, for want of a better word, or I'm going to make the claim that eating animal-derived meat will be illegal in at least one country. If I had to hazard a guess, I'd say Israel or maybe Singapore, you know, will make it illegal to eat.
Mainly because they've got the big biotech businesses already and agritech located there. So I also I agree with you on that suddenly we will have... And not just moral, I think it will also be just about, you know, saving the planet, saving the ecosystem, that we may have to introduce such drastic bans. I mean, my predictions are not, I'd say, as brilliant this time round. I was told off the last time for being too exotic and too extravagant in my thinking. So I'm going to give you some fairly simple ones, which you can go yes or no to, okay? So my first one is, rather than whinging about online retailing, I'm going to predict that UK retailers will join forces and form an association and just get on with exploiting the online world, as they should be doing. I'm going to give you next prediction, that we're talking about current climate change in a negative way. And I kind of go, gosh, you know, is that going to change? Well, I'm predicting that food brands, particularly to your point about, you know, the notion of getting rid of natural meat. I'm going to say they're going to be using things like wildfires, pandemic, mutually assured nuclear destruction as ways to promote and market new kinds of doomsday foods. Okay. And then my third prediction, and you've just got to choose one of these, is that we will see social media platforms, but essentially we are just getting rewarded in a proper way for the data we put up. And the more we drive people to our sites, the more we get paid for doing it. So direct exchange. So which of those do you think, if any, you should put your money on in terms of making me wealthy and you getting a bit of cash on the side as well?
Oh, definitely the meat, you know, one where, because that's already happening. You know, we're already seeing all the big meat producers investing in their lab-grown alternatives at the same time as suing them and trying to stop them calling vegan sausages. And again, that's a classic kind of innovation lesson, isn't it? I do think the market and big corporates are much more mature and savvy than they were perhaps a generation ago around, you know, the concept of disruption is so well known now that you know they are prepared to invest in their competitors, you know, future competitors at an earlier stage. Just like we've said with the model of trends, you know, that is a prediction about the future that's kind of grounded in the present. Like mm-hmm. You know, and this is what we always say, the pandemic, you know, everyone's like, well, what's new things have happened? And the truth is, I mean, I would always challenge you, it's something that I've been asking myself, is there a trend that's come out of a pandemic that's truly new? Or it was always, I mean, you know, there were remote only companies beforehand, yeah. You know, Automattic and Buffer. I haven't yet seen anyone suggest that there was a consumer behavior or business practice that was truly invented, you know, started in the last 12 months. They were always happening somewhere by a small pocket of people.
And it's slightly, I guess they're slightly accelerating it. That, you know, that's the thing.
Exactly, they're just accelerating it.
Well, good, that's all we have time for. I'm just going to give you my quick solutions. The UK Digital Business Association, would you believe, has been launched at last. You know, rather than whinging about the internet, retailers have finally gone, gosh, this thing has been around for quite a long time. Let's just get up there and take some cash out of the market as well, not challenge ASOS, etc. Climate prices, food brands. Would you believe there's a tea brand called The End, which is now using wildfires and pandemics and mutually assured nuclear destruction to sell teas that calm you and prepare you for the worst. I quite like that. And then there is a platform called Twitch, which is just launched to kind of combat Twitter, which is there to help us profit from our data. Henry, thank you again for joining me. And just to remind people, the book is called The Future Normal, and it's appearing next year, but I'm guessing you'll be writing about it and talking about it over the next few months before you start working with Brent and his team. And I'm hoping that the book will be as successful as your last one has been. Until next time, everybody, keep listening, looking, learning, and of course, asking about what's new and what's next. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Martin. Thank you.